This is the Conversation Three-Way, the inaugural episode. I am Michael Shaw. I want to thank everyone who supported the podcast during the Kickstarter campaign again. You have made this next incarnation possible, so thank you very much again. So today on the show, we have Urs Fischer at MoCA Los Angeles. And speaking of Los Angeles, is there room for art fairs in Los Angeles? And then our final segment, obscure artists you don't know about, but probably should. I want to say hello to my guest today for the inaugural show, veteran, alumni of the podcast, and man about town, Aaron Morse. Hello, Aaron.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for
having me. And another veteran of the show and alumni of the New York Times celebration section, Carl Haddell. Hello, Carl.
Hello.
So Urs Fischer, if I'm saying that right, is the superstar Swiss artist transplanted to New York for the last several years. The survey at MoCA LA follows his large-scale museum solo, Urs Fischer, Marguerite de Ponty, in late 2009, early 2010, at the New Museum in New York. The show takes place at both MoCA Grand Avenue and the Geffen, a double team of shows that hasn't happened in a very long time. We'll have to see if our guests know, my co-hosts know where that might have, when that last might have happened. The exhibition is curated by a woman named Jessica Morgan, who is curator, international art, Tate Modern, a.k.a. the Descalopolis Curator International Art. Morgan has worked with Fischer on projects for about a decade. In L.A., Fischer has had a solo show last year at Gagosian in Beverly Hills and also had a single piece in MoCA's abstraction show, The Factory After Warhol, which is about a year ago as well. And before we get started, if anyone in the Urs Fischer studio is listening to this out in Red Hook, please let Urs know that he has an open invitation to come on the show, and he may be interested after we have what we have to say, but that remains to be seen. So, Carl, what did you think of the show?
First impression, I liked it. I think I really did like it.
Okay, I'm surprised. Continue. Okay.
Why are you surprised?
Well, I think I'm anticipating something very different from Aaron, but and I guess I was expecting the same from you. So continue.
I thought the Geffen part was really fantastic. There was a lot of energy in that space. I'm unsure about, like, do I like it better that they're volunteers that helped out, or is it better that, or should it have been paid? Because it has a sort of relationship to Solowit. Solowit has a big show at a museum, and all the young artists come and work on it. I did that once, and I got paid. But in the other hand, there's a kind of generosity about people volunteering, and it looked like they had fun, and you could see that they had fun. I walked through the Grand Avenue part very quickly, and I realized that, I mean, I didn't have much time, and you don't need a lot of time to see Urs Fischer, which is good and bad. It's kind of really good art fair art. It doesn't reward careful looking. When you get close to work, it doesn't reveal more. And in fact, when I was down there, I looked at some of the paintings, and I was like, these look just as good. These look better in reproduction, maybe. They look exactly like the reproductions. And a lot of times you see work and it looks different in reproduction, but his looks good in reproduction. In fact, it might look better. So then I walked over to the Pollocks because I was like, maybe these Pollocks don't really reward careful viewing. But then you get close and you see different things, and the same with the Rothkos. I just walked across to the other half of the museum. So now... But there's some parts of it that are just so whimsical and charming and have a kind of level of entry for kind of a populist level of entry that I think is great. Like the bread house is just, it's just wonderful. It's a dumb, stupid, wonderful idea. And there were a lot of kids there in school groups when I was there. And the fact that they can look at it and be like, I can do this, I thought was wonderful. And I say that I enjoyed it because I think I'm contrasting him to artists like Jeff Koons or Richard Prince, which I think he might now be in that orbit, or Murakami, and whose work generally I don't like. And
how are you comparing him to that group?
Well, I think he might, in terms of auction prices and where he's at now, he might be in that group.
Really? Aaron, do you have any idea if that's the case?
I'm not sure exactly. I'd imagine that he's probably, I think Koons is sort of in the stratosphere from what I understand. Yeah. So, sure. You know, maybe Ur's, who knows, maybe he's a 10th. I don't know, but that's...
But has his work come up for auction much? Because I don't remember seeing his work coming up for auction.
Yeah, he's over the $1 million mark. And
gotta be.
And now
that he's... But what's Koons in, like, tens of millions of dollars?
Well, the point that I was... What I was sure. Maybe it's unfair. And maybe it's not a good comparison. But, you know, I know that he now shows with Gagosian. And so I start comparing him to those type of artists. And I think that... When you go to see Koons, there's so much labor is hidden, and the materials are so rarefied. It's the same with Murakami. And the thing about Urs Fischer, it's really very basic materials. And I kind of liked that you can that there isn't a lot of processes that are hidden. It's all kind of out there. And in the way that Koons has tons of people working for him, and you get a really slick surface, Urs Fischer, at least in like the clay piece, had a ton of people working for him. And it's all evident. And that part, I think, was made me... I liked it more in comparison to them. However, the negative is that it's not really very... The work is not very rich. It's not rich in terms of emotion, in terms of content, of, you know, like the kind of more difficult things to talk about in life. He doesn't get to those things, and the way he deals with death is just very superficial and almost like a joking way of dealing with death. So that said, I like wanted to dislike it more, but he's just really witty in a way that a lot of artists aren't, and that's enjoyable to see someone who's, I mean, the guy is fun, is smart, and then maybe if the prices weren't so high, and if it wasn't Jeffrey Deitch doing it, and you just saw this work in a smaller gallery, you would be like, this guy is really a generous, fun artist.
Did you feel, seeing the show at Geffen, which are the clay sculptures, that show was called Yes, I believe, right? 1,500 volunteers working on these clay sculptures for a week or whatever it was. So did you have substantially different, you know, feelings between there and his own work over at the other space?
I thought that the Geffen work was better. I really enjoyed it. It filled up the space great, and it was just such a simple idea. And at the same time, you know, you could spend so much time in there looking through all these different things. And that was what was different in the Geffen show. There was a lot of detail. Like, you can get really close. I mean, it was almost like excavation. Like, you were looking at a going through some caves and seeing a different world. So I preferred that to the Mocha show, the main Mocha show. I don't know. It wasn't great.
Okay.
I agree with Carl about the better part of the two-part show is the Geffen installation. There's sort of a nice, cool clay that's been used by the, you know, public who's come in to make sculptures of whatever they suited their fancy. I think they had total creative freedom to do so, versus the concrete of the floors, and then there's the white of the drywall and the nice space of the Geffen. So it has a sort of nice feel when you go in. And I think the project has kind of a cute idea, like, you know, bring the public in and we'll feed them lunch and, you know, people can do whatever they like. But I must say, I think I had read something where there's a comparison maybe to as these sculptures that people have made out of the clay dry and fall apart because they're not fired and permanent, that it evokes ruins. But I don't think it evokes ruins at all. I think it's more like if you, and I don't mean this to be overly mean, because I think it's nice. Like, let's say you were walking down the beach and you came across a sandcastle contest, and, you know, you'd have fun. Like, oh, there's Marilyn Monroe, there's a mermaid, there's like a dinosaur. It's like you'd have fun looking at that, but you wouldn't consider that to be great art. It would just be a sandcastle contest. And that's sort of the level it gets to ultimately for me. Because ruination happens when something significant begins to fall apart, like a factory or a town or something that has significant kind of energy and investment to it. Whereas this is just, you know, people's sort of high school doodling impulses. So, you know, like a dragon here. And I'm, you know, I'm not begrudging or saying there's anything bad about the kids who went and made sculptures there and had fun. That's awesome. But I think it doesn't really approach, it doesn't have a lot of gravitas for me, that, that piece. It's sort of, it's nice, but it's slight. And it's by far the better part of the two shows. And
see, I agree with the first part of what you're saying, but continue.
Well, and isn't it, perhaps it's telling that the best piece in Urza's show is the piece that he and his studio did not make. So, I mean, you go to the Geffen.
Okay, which one did you guys start with?
I'm sorry. You should go to Grand Avenue. I started at the Geffen.
Okay.
So no, I'm sorry. No, I said that incorrectly. I started at Grand Avenue and then I went to
Okay, that's what I did too. And you?
I went to the Geffen first.
Okay. Continue, Aaron.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I notice when I go to that show is so Urs Fischer's reputation precedes him. He's this kind of pop punk, perhaps bad boy, has a lot of, you know, attention. So I was excited to see this show. Like, what am I going to see? What kind of wild, sort of over the top sculpture and what sort of ideas are going to be presented that are going to be provocative and challenging? And what I saw was just an incredibly sort of cliched and hackneyed sort of arrangement of, you know, skeletons and sort of poor art materials sort of put together, but looked by rushed and disinterested studio assistants. And then there were some objects in the show that have a higher degree of fabrication. Maybe those are the more recent ones where there's more funds available. But like these sort of more slick and metallic kinds of sculptures. And Carl had mentioned the graphic images that show a like a 1950s movie star head with fruit over the face. And those are probably the most like...
the problem kind of, paintings.
Yeah, and those are very ingratiating images that are very easily sort of reproduced and transmitted, and they have a stylistic pop or an imagistic pop to them. But they're really just big Photoshop blow-ups that are glued down on a support, maybe with a tiny bit of spray paint or something. And I just thought they were pretty ugly and that they didn't really have much more presence than a... bus stop kind of billboard or something. And I mean, I think that if you compare Urs Fischer with, well, certainly he doesn't compare well with like the greats of all time, you know, working in junk sculpture, like Claes Oldenburg, for example. I mean, when you think of like sort of lumpy sculptures or, cast off materials, like, you know, he's pretty good, but I don't think that Urs even compares well with other people who are working in the expanded studio field where you're leveraging studio assistants and fabrication shops and other teams to help execute your artistic vision. And I think artists really have a responsibility if they're going to work with those larger tools to really bring them to bear and still make excellent artwork.
Well, I have to say I disagree with you on just about everything, both of you guys. So maybe this will start making things interesting. First of all, Aaron, just with your last point, I feel like, sure. I mean, I think it was uneven. I think the show at Grand Avenue was uneven. There are some pieces that are pretty weak and then there are others that are quite strong. And I actually feel like having the resources of that studio and money is what has led him and his team to create the mirror glass objects, which I think are really, really, really strong. I regret not seeing the ones at the new museum, which were much larger, and I think maybe were even on stainless steel, if I remember right, you know, and that they were like human height, 6 feet or even larger, whereas these were these little box, you know, 1 foot to 2 foot deals. But I still think they're great objects. I mean, I think it's a great idea, as superficial as it may be, you know. I mean, certainly... the case with the Grand Avenue show, as seductive as some of the objects were, you know, they probably don't linger with you for very long. Indeed. Meanwhile, and we can come back to that, but meanwhile, the show at the Geffen, which were, you know, an infinite number of gray clay remains scattered through, you know, at the bottoms of these cell-like rooms scattered throughout the Geffen. I mean, I was, you know, I was kind of somewhat enjoying it in the process of going through it. But then I, as I got further and further from that event, I felt like, Jesus, what a depressing environment that was. All these cell-like rooms with the sunlight, you know, coming in, but then kind of only hitting the tops of the walls, you know, and all this sort of shadows gathering down at the bottom. And, you know, aside from that, I could not help but think of that project as a cynical way for Fisher to ingratiate himself to the public art making process, you know, that he was making public art, and that this would therefore, you know, in turn, you know, give him a gravitas, to use your word, you know, of sort of working across, you know, income fields or what have you.
So that's very cynical. So you think he actually is strategic, that he planned this out?
I think on some level he had to go through that process, you know, that thinking process.
Here I can be nice.
Okay. Fair enough.
I don't know.
I thought you were going to be nice.
Oh, no. Oh, never.
Well, go ahead. I mean, let me see if I have anything
well,
to
so,
add.
Well, so, okay. So let's, I mean, but that is sort of a contradiction. And I think it further conceptually shows how confused the show is. It doesn't really know what it wants to be. Like, are you this sort of generous Rickrit-like figure that's feeding the masses and having them, you know, help make something about contemporary life? Or are you like a punk who's like making aggressive antisocial art that's like, putting its thumb in the, I don't know, whatever, the eye of art world mores?
Yeah, because he's saying, fuck it, I'm going to give this space to the public. You know, that's radical, right? Isn't it ultimately hard for any of us to see that as really radical? I mean, when he has the whole other space to work with.
It's not radical, but it's in a vein of relational aesthetics, and it's bringing together relational aesthetics, conceptualism, and sculpture. And it does have, I really think it is a very good piece, and it does have a relationship to the history of sculpture throughout, going back to the Renaissance. I mean, it's so much figurative work. It's a big, giant figurative sculpture. It could be something from like unearthed out of some Greek, you know, runes.
Do you remember any of the pieces?
No, you do. Yeah, well, there are lots of little figures. I don't remember any specific ones.
There's a ton
animals.
Of little Jeffrey Deitch heads.
Are there?
Yes.
Those are online. I remember those from online.
Yeah.
But no, I don't remember anything specific. I remember all generalities, like how much figurative work there was, which tells us something about like a kind of psychological impulse among like kids and people who aren't trained in art, that when we are given art materials, we paint or sculpt ourselves. I think that's pretty interesting. And I think that the naivete that he captured there, I really do think it was basic and simple, like in premise, and I don't look for anything too... Like, I'm a pretty cynical guy, but I'm not that cynical to think that he tried to ingratiate himself into the LA art audience.
He probably didn't. I'm sure he didn't. You know, most artists are not, you know, they're not that calculating.
Well, I mean, what I'm trying to say is that he decided to give up his control while maintaining his control in a certain way. And that in turn was, you know, on a local level, being generous to the community. You know, and it became this art project, you know, where the public, both young and old, because there were not just kids involved in this, you know, got to exercise, you know, what we don't know is to what degree he was involved in the supervision, you know, not that that's ultimately that important, but I'm kind of curious.
Do you think he was steaming the kale himself that was served?
I think there were instructions given on the type of figuration or the type of work that they should do. I think they were supposed to do figures and animals.
Okay.
I don't know. There was a wall text that suggested that.
And he gave these instructions?
I don't know. I mean, okay. I sensed that it wouldn't, that there was some degree. But in terms of how an artist works with assistants, I think that this was a pretty successful successful example and kind of an exploration of what happens when one works with assistants. And the working of with assistants has been something that's going on a long time in art, and it went from Michelangelo to Solowit, and this takes it a different step. And there is always this element of control versus not control, and that's always what you're doing.
But the big
I work with assistants, so maybe I had a different take on it. I don't work with 1500 though. So.
But the difference, the obvious difference between this and a Saul LeWitt is that when your posse is finished with the work, you know, you're left with a pretty interesting wall work or otherwise. Whereas in this case, you know, for me, you're left with something highly forgettable and in some ways a little depressing. I mean, I remember making at a certain point wanting to make my way through those rooms so I could get to the Urs Fischer pieces, you know, the giant.
Right, the melting candle pieces.
Exactly.
And how do you think those worked with fit in with the clay pieces?
It was kind of interesting. I mean, you look from the center of the Geffen down, you know, through the space, and you know, through those cells, and you see in the back room, you know, that towering, you know, Italian copy in the background. It's kind of interesting, you know. I mean, again, to be a little cynical, you know, it's kind of like, you know, where are the Urs Fischer's original? That was a little bit my experience. I mean, I'm hard pressed to remember more than one or two of the individual clay pieces. And maybe that's from Carl's perspective, not what it's about, because it's kind of taking in a process. But I mean, for me, looking back, it was a little bit of a sad experience.
But you will remember the overall effect of looking down from on the balcony or walking in there and seeing all this clay and smelling all that. You remember that.
Yes, I think that remains to be seen. I think that's a good point.
No, and that's true. And I think that actually when I went through the Geffen, I think I had largely positive feelings sort of walking through it. My only issue is actually, I think it's a nice idea and I think it's a good piece. But I don't think it rises to the level of great by any means. And I'm much more concerned about the work at the Grand Avenue space, and because that's his... You know, that's the work that he and his studio has made, specifically these whatever discrete objects or installations that have been made over the last 15 years or whatever he's been working. And I wonder, can we talk about the skeletons?
Okay, we'll make this the last of this segment. But yeah, let's talk about the skeletons. Did you, first of all, I take it you hadn't been aware of some of this work before, so it was kind of all a surprise to you?
You know, I've mostly just encountered his work reproduced. You know,
yeah, but had you not seen those skeletons reproduced?
Yeah, I think so. But again, when they're, you know, images as opposed to objects, they get away with a lot more.
Sure, mm-hmm.
And I think. I think it's also always helpful to compare people and, like, you know, think of other artists who are around his age and, you know, maybe working broadly in the same kind of sculptural or installational areas. And I mean, this is maybe not quite fair because he sort of entered into art history, but like think of Jason Rhodes and his installations and like the real perversity, the real mischief and how provocative those are. And they crackle with life, those installations of Jason Rhodes. And, you know, I've been annoyed by those by Rhodes installations and sort of thrilled by them in equal measure. And I just don't feel like I got that here at all. I feel his, you know, I don't know if the use of also these skeletons do nothing to enlighten us about real, you know, about mortality or absurdism or, I mean, and you think of, I think recently, like a lot of people in LA probably know about Liz Craft's skeleton on a motorcycle sculpture from, you know, 10 years back or whatever, or Ricky Swallow's exquisite sculptures with skulls in them. And I mean, those are, I just think, much more serious kind of deliberations. And, you know, skulls and skeletons are a kind of an eternal subject in art. And, you know, from Hamlet to, you know, James Ensor and anybody else you want to pick out. And I just don't think that he's doing very much with them. And they're really, as sculptures, they're pretty crappy. Like the craft of them is terrible. And, oh, I just think they're bad.
Well, tell me what piece you liked in the show.
In the Grand Avenue space?
Yeah.
I mean, I think you could say that where he punches out the walls, at least there's like a naked sort of aggression and mass movement that creates some force in the space and alters it architecturally. But I don't know if that does rise to the level to save his objects, which I think are just so much poorer than his contemporaries. And for my money, if you're going to, you know, spend what people are spending on Urs, why wouldn't you get good sculpture? Like, you know.
So you didn't. So you don't like the stainless steel pieces then, or the mirrored glass pieces?
They're very slight sort of pieces. I mean, no.
Okay.
I just think that as you go around and sort of look at them, and I think when you compare them with, you know, Sam Durant or any number of other people who have made furniture like...
You're using all L.A. artists, you know that. So this is like a fuck you to New York kind
of thing. He doesn't travel. This is basically drives to see art. Which is environmentally... That's better than flying.
That's right.
Oh, God bless you, Aaron.
Oh, God, I got it. Crap. Now I have to think of a New Yorker that I like. So this is very nice.
Okay. To be continued, ladies and gentlemen. Let's move on to topic two, shall we? Before we do, this week's sponsor is Made with Color, a DIY website builder for creative professionals. Made with Color has a special discount code for the Conversation podcast listeners. It's Conversation, all lowercase letters. The discount code is good for 29% off the first year of your membership. So go check out madewithcolor.com to get your site started today. All right, on to topic two. Is there room for art fairs in Los Angeles? On May 16th, it was reported that Art Platform LA, one of the fairs around town, is canceling its fall 2013 fair and perhaps forever, which may have everything to do with its location, that is Los Angeles. So what is the state of art fairs this spring and the future of art fairs in Los Angeles? Now, Morris has taken upon himself to talk to some people in the know. Aaron, what do you know?
Well, I've been talking with lots of, you know, friends and some of whom are dealers or other artists and some collectors for years about these LA fairs. It's sort of a, you know, regular topic of conversation. Like, what'd you think of that last fair? You know, what are we going to do about it? Is anything ever going to happen with that? And so, you know, I think that there have been many attempts to try and make a fair really excellent and go here. And I think that that is in the interest of all of the dealers and basically the community more broadly.
Can you break it down a little bit why it's in their interest? I mean, other than obviously the cost of traveling to New York, et cetera.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. I think that, I mean, the short answer is that the LA art market is small. There's just not that many collectors here. And there's also not that many collectors that, what would you say, have large collections where they're really buying a lot. And so there's always a need or a desire that the galleries have to try and bring people to Los Angeles. And so I think that's why there's always a desire to have a fair and have something come. But then that's when the sort of mixed psychology and dysfunction maybe starts to come out. For example, there doesn't seem to be, I think from what I could gather from speaking with people about Art Platform, there was never dealer buy-in for it. So the best dealers in town, or the largest, Blum & Poe, Regan, etc., they wouldn't commit to the fair or wouldn't commit to it until, you know, Hauser and Wirth came, or Zwirner was going to come. And then those people wouldn't come unless Blum & Poe came or Regan came. And so, you know, you had a disconnect there. And even, you know, collectors like Eli Broad, from what I was told, did not particularly get behind the fair and took more of a wait and see approach. And you could contrast that with something like the Dallas Fair, which, again, what dealer told me, collectors would call their dealers that they work with and ask them to do that fair and to support it and come be a part of that art fair as a favor to them, you know, with the idea that then that plant will get watered. And so I think in LA, people always, you know, the community here is sort of very much, this is a Western place, there's sort of a, even though it's sort of broadly politically liberal, I think people, there's not a lot of really collective community spirit in some ways. It seems like someone's always waiting for another group to take on the burden.
Right. Yeah, I think that's that point about we're not going to be on board unless they're on board kind of thing. I mean, that's really kind of unfortunate. I guess it's the culture of branding, you know, in a sense. You know, we're not going to brand this thing ourselves. We need somebody else to brand with us, or, you know, I mean, we can't do it on our own because we're not going to carry the load.
Well, and let's be honest. I mean, and I'm certainly not, I mean, I would love it if there was a good art fair in Los Angeles as much as anybody, but the art fairs have been pretty modest in scale. They've been using older buildings and venues that do not bring a lot of excitement, and the level of dealer representation has been, middling. So I think there's not a lot of, also, there's never been a real program to sync up events. Like, you know, if you could have Perry Photo and Art LA and Art Platform or other, spin-off kind of fairs or smaller fairs happen more at the same time, if you could have a big spectacular sort of venue that was really first rate, maybe even have some kind of tie-in with more like a Pacific Rim theme where you were bringing in galleries from Asia. So then that allows an incentive for those on the East Coast to come out here because it's a lot closer to fly to Los Angeles than it is to fly to Asia to maybe visit some of those dealers in person. Then that could work. But we haven't seen that develop.
Meanwhile, I want to go back to your point.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
You said you would like it as much as the next guy if there'd be a fair in L.A.?
Sure.
But why? One, you're assuming that the next guy wants to have a fair in L.A.? I don't want there to be a fair in L.A. Or I don't care if there's a fair in L.A., a successful one.
The reason I would like to see it is just the basic logic of it, that it would help the L.A. galleries.
Yeah, I mean, Carl, I mean, I think the subtext of your point, the other side of your point, is that, you know, you may be doing okay through your respective dealers, but there are a lot of LA. I mean,
it's great for you, Carl.
Yeah, exactly.
You're doing fine. the rest of us are dying out here.
The classic.
There's
line,
enough art fairs.
But the classic line that I keep hearing, though, is from dealers, you know, and artists alike, is, you know, no, quote unquote, nobody collects in LA. You know, so the art fair is the way to supplement those issues, those shortcomings. Right. In theory.
So, meaning the, which they do, the galleries go to the art fairs in other cities and sell their wares to collectors in New York and Europe. So there's no point to have the fair in LA if the collector base isn't here in LA.
Well, wait a second. But if you're a small gallery with a really minimal budget, then you participate in a local fair and New York and potentially Europe comes to you.
But your gallery is in LA. So why do you have to go
right,
rent a truck and move your art to a convention center when you should
sure
be able to attract the people through your exhibitions and your program to the gallery?
Well, one of the counter theory to that might be, and I'm speculating, that it's a one-stop shop deal, you know, where a Parisian or a Zurich collector comes to LA, they go to a fair and they don't, you know, I mean, it seems like those people, those kinds of collectors would come to a fair in LA and then they would do all the galleries as well. But I don't know. I mean, that, I suppose, is the theory, if any.
Some do, but I think that L.A. is very well represented in the major fairs, and those collectors are getting a lot of L.A. And maybe they're not getting a good, you know, cross-the-board representation. They're getting a select sampling by certain, people who have certain tastes and power. But if there was no L.A. presence, you might have a better case, but LA makes it to most of the big fairs. There's plenty of LA galleries and all in, even in Basel, the regular old Basel, that there, and LA artists, we have better artists than fairs and maybe galleries, because I mean, we have a number of good galleries, but we have a lot of really great artists who show with galleries all over the world. So it's almost like it's not necessary because the artists are being seen outside of LA. So we're not being collected as much in LA. I don't think that it's the fair's fault. I think that's more about the taste of Los Angeles and the relationship to Hollywood, perhaps.
Right. And let me just follow your point. David McDonald, an artist who weighed in on this topic to me, said, quite honestly, I don't know why any would want to try to start another one in LA. I don't know of one that has succeeded. They might have a decent year or two, but that's about it. He says, on a related note, I think we need less fairs. There's at least one every week somewhere in the world. With that many, the quality has to decline. Artists can't produce on that level. Galleries can't have that much inventory, and collectors can't have that much money. So I don't know. That puts a cap on it. Meanwhile, should we talk about Paris Photo at all? I mean, because that seemed to be a pretty hot affair that took place last month. That is April. Certainly, Perry Rubenstein seemed to be all a flutter about how great it was. Maybe he, as Aaron suggested to me on the phone the other day, maybe because he had really good sales. But I mean, do we want to even talk about that? I mean, none of us went, so none of us are really qualified.
Went.
Oh, no, you went.
I did.
I'm sorry. Take it away, Aaron.
No, I it was fun. It's on the Paramount back lot. And so I think that people enjoyed that, the sort of surrealism of fake New York and fake storefronts. And, you know, there was some beautifully set up sound stages also where people had booths. The few dealers that I talked to seemed that it was good, if not great, in terms of sales. It probably depends, again, on who, you know, the individual and how they happen to be doing it at that moment. But I hope it'll come back and be here again. I think it was a lot more lively and more enjoyable, at least from my standpoint. Also, one thing that was interesting is that unlike a lot of photo fairs, which tend to be sort of like photo ghetto fairs, this one had galleries who show any kind of artwork or genre presenting their photographic artists. So that was nice. And I think that rose, made the level of the artwork rise. There was some really good, like there were Bruce Conner films being screened and, you know, numerous other kind of high points.
And are they slated, as far as you know, to go again same time next year?
You know, I don't know that. I would assume that they'll do it again. And whether or not it'll be at Paramount again, I don't know, but that seemed to work. I can follow that up. Perhaps we can put that on the website. We can answer that question at a later date.
That sounds good.
Quick note from the producer. After further investigation, Aaron discovered that indeed Paris Photo will be continuing for 2 more years on the Paramount lot. That is all.
You know, I should say regarding the fairs in LA, I didn't go to Paris Photo, but I went to a different photo fair a couple of years ago. And I have gone to some of the fairs in the Barker Hangar. And I like them in a way that I have not liked the major fairs that always depress me for so many reasons normally because I'm involved in them. But I liked the LA fair and how manageable it was, how easy it was to get in and out, how you can do it and not feel overwhelmed. People were generally friendly. There wasn't that much at stake in the sense that like that major collectors aren't running around like having to get, you know, and the dealers weren't trying to sell stuff like crazy because they were sort of resigned to not selling that much stuff. And in that way, it did have a little bit of a community feel. Like, we're all in this together, like the dealers and the artists, like we're kind of doing this for each other. So I enjoyed it more. But in the same time, I was like, why do we need to go to a fair to have a community? And that felt really sad. And you were talking about this. Like, yeah. If the community got together, we could have a good fair. Why does the art community, I mean, I don't even know what that is exactly, but why should we organize ourselves to get behind a commercial enterprise?
But I think, isn't that the only real type of scenario where people do come together? I mean, because otherwise, if it's one gallery's event, you know, it's their crowd, you know? So what other situation are all the, you know, various participants and players going to gather together in one place and kind of be on an even playing field?
Well, there in Chinatown used to have this performance festival that's happened for a few years, which I liked. Pacific Standard Time is an example of where there was a lot of people who were seeing each other at events over and over again. There was dialogue that was moving from one event to one, maybe a few weeks later. People did come into town to see that. Of course, that required money too, but I guess just one really rich donor gave that money. But I thought that was a better example of how you can have show contemporary and historical work, how you can have a dialogue, how you can have a community, and it could be around a series of events.
Well, of course, that would always be preferable to have it around real art and real events and things that are more grassroots. I mean, I think that art fairs have grown into this brutal system that, you know, people participate in. And I think it's the ugliness of art fairs is just the, you know, the same as the ugliness of all business, you know, and art has grown into being kind of a big industry. And it really, I don't think art fairs on the whole have been good for art. perhaps they have led to more artists being able to survive and have money in between shows. I don't know. It's a mixed bag, but I do think that having an art fair in Los Angeles is a goal for many. I'm not saying it's something that's keeping me awake at night personally, but I can see why there is desire among the dealers to have one here.
Let me ask you something. In your experience, have you found that your dealers have, it seems to me at least, that the focus on the constant art fairs has taken away the focus for the gallery exhibition, which is something that when I first started looking at art and when I lived in New York, it was really important to see whatever that month's show was at a gallery. And the gallery exhibition still meant a lot. And now the gallery exhibitions, unless you're at one of these really big galleries, it's too much for a lot of galleries to put on a really good exhibition and to get their booth in order for that month. And the gallery exhibitions have suffered, and I've had dealers sort of like not even caring what goes on in the gallery as long as they know what they're getting for the fair. And the commercial gallery exhibition was a way for the public to see art for free. And I think it's directly suffering because of art fairs.
Oh, absolutely. I think that the art fairs lead to, people being overworked and overstressed. And of course business people who have small businesses have to make what decisions they can to make the most money and survive till, the next tax time. And I don't think it's better for art. I think it's unfortunate. I think that gallery shows are, as they are sort of developed and worked on, are always better. And I think you make a great point about that being the public sort of losing out because art fairs are difficult, are elitist, and are expensive and hard to get to and all of those other things.
Yeah.
Have either of you guys been to Frieze in the last couple of years?
The one in New York or London?
New York.
Yeah.
What was your experience of that?
On a purely aesthetic level, it's a good fair. That big light box effect really works. So much for me about a fair, and I guess for many people, is the quality of the art, which is related to the quality of the dealers that are in the fair. So, for a while, everyone was going to the Armory. Now the Armory, now
Moribund.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now maybe the Armory will come back. So it's like, it's not the fair. It's not the name of the fair. And they even, the owners will change the name. It's really the participation and who's in it. I went to Frieze, not this past one, but the one before. And I thought it was a pretty high level work. And it was an enjoyable fair for me for the most part. Yeah.
How did it?
I think I sold my work there, so I was happy. Okay.
Well, I think you anticipated my question, which was going to be how is it better than the other fairs you've been to because you sold the work.
Well, I have fairs I sell and some that I don't, but I only had one piece there, and I think it sold.
So you were doing champagne toast down the down
no,
the booths?
No, actually, when I see my work, I luckily went when my work wasn't up. Like that day, they had switched it. The dealer had switched it, but. When I see my own work in the fair, it is really depressing for me.
Why?
Well, because, you walk in, and this happened. I had a real kind of, I didn't say a meltdown. I behaved very badly at one Art Basel, Miami, one of the Miami fairs. Because you walk in, the thing is humongous. You need a map to find your own art. And you finally find it, and you've looked through so many rectangles, hundreds of rectangles on the walls. And some of these are your heroes. Like you see Richter, you see Picasso. Finally, you get to the younger galleries, or I am in the younger galleries. And Richter and Picasso already look like shit because they're in there. And last week it was a lawnmower in that same spot. And the lighting is terrible. The carpet is, it's terrible. So you already realize that even your heroes, the people you look up to, maybe to some degree you're looking up to them a little less now, they look just like everything else. And then you come to yours and you're like, what is the point? I've just seen the 1,000th rectangle in the past hour and it's mine. And I can't tell if it's better or worse. What am I doing here?
Right.
Why don't I just sell lawnmowers next week? It's the same thing. It's very, very depressing.
Yeah. I mean, you put your finger on something that I've been wanting to say just strictly from the experience of the art fair, which is I went to the Armory many years ago. And I really haven't been to art fair since, here's the thing. We all have different degrees of sensitivity and openness, I mean, obviously, as artists, many of us are very sensitive. But, you know, there's some people I think that can go to art fairs, have a filter, sort of hone in on the stuff that interests them and kind of filter out a lot of the other stuff. But for the rest of us, it's kind of like this smorgasbord where we're taking in, you know, ridiculous amounts that are, you know, kind of not really maybe giving us a stomach ache so much as maybe giving us food poisoning, you know, like just there's just too much stuff. And, you know, that brings the level down of the stuff that you're interested in. And, you know, yeah, I mean, going through all those booths, you know, if you go to a decent size one, and that, meanwhile, back to the modest LA fair idea, that starts to sound kind of good. And that's what a lot of people were saying about Art LA, particularly leading up to this last one, that it was like a really small, friendly, you know, accessible mm-hmm. kind of thing. So maybe even if it's a financial loss, you know, maybe these things are this kind of some version of that in LA is useful, perhaps. I don't know.
But I don't understand why it needs to be in the fair context. Why do you need to have a friendly community-like atmosphere with a bunch of local art dealers in an environment that's easy for people to go through? Why don't they just make an exhibition? What used to happen, but there's fewer and fewer of these sort of big thematic exhibitions happening throughout the world. There's art fairs and there's biennials. And there used to be, and there still are some large thematic exhibitions, but you could have that if you took all the money that people spent on this. If they know they're not even going to sell anything, why don't all the dealers get together, rent a warehouse, and put together a thematic exhibition, hire a curator and do that? There are just better ways to do it and not in this little booth with these fake walls. It's just so constructed and unideal.
Well, let's, joyless.
Well, let's, soul-sucking.
Let's take that proposal to a practical level, Carl. Who do you have in mind to lead the charge, I think is the real question. You know, because we can sit here and philosophize all day about, you know, what a great idea it is, but at the end of the day, scrap that from the record. I hate that cliche.
Ultimately,
thank you, Aaron. If somebody is going to do an event, you know, if they're going to do a fair, they're going to get some money up front from the booths, you know, so they kind of cover their asses. But if they're going to put on sort of a non-entity or an independent kind of event, they have potentially a lot to lose unless somebody's backing them, right?
I suppose. But there was recently there was this whole thing with a bunch of, I don't know, the money came from France, and there were a bunch of French curators coming to LA, and they did a bunch of sort of France, LA stuff going on. And there was a great curator named Marc-Olivier Waller, who was in LA for a while. And he did a show at the Barnsdall Art Center, which no one saw, which was great. There are things happening. And I guess maybe that, I don't know, there's a PR problem maybe with some of the
Marc-Olivier, is that his name?
Yeah, Marc-Olivier Waller. But he curated this show, did a bunch of stuff here in L.A., and I don't even need, do you know the name of this France-L.A. Kind of sister city?
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about. The one that they started years ago, right, where it was an exchange program where they had L.A. artists in the Pompidou, right? And then they had a show of maybe a French artist here. Something to that effect?
Well,
is that related?
Clearly, we need to have more information.
Oops.
And their PR needs to be better, because this just came to mind as something where there was a quality exhibition that people didn't see.
Yeah.
Anyway,
well, I'm using this as a call out to Marc-Olivier Waller to, you know, keep up the fight and, you know, and keep it going. All right. So let's move on to obscure artists that you haven't heard of, but probably should have. And Carl, do you want to start? Carl, who do you have?
I have two. The first one is an older artist who you should have heard of. His name is David Robbins. He was an 80s artist, lived in New York, showed at Nature Mort. He had a fairly good career going for a while. He probably still could if he wanted to, but I think he's a little too idealistic. And he is well known for a piece called Talent, which was headshots of 80s artists. And a great piece, well, it was a number of pieces called Ice Cream Social, which was this sort of proposed TV show. It was a book around the idea of like an ice cream social, and it's sort of like part critique, part relational aesthetics, part pop. And he is an artist who is a real populist in the sense that he doesn't want his work to be like be in W Magazine. He wants to be on like Oprah Magazine. And I think he's a great artist, and he's going to make a comeback. No, I'm not. I'm not friends with him.
Okay.
I'm going to try to become friends with him.
Okay.
And another artist who is a young artist from L.A., who her name is Christina Wong. She just graduated UCLA, and she shows going to have a show.
Wait, right? Christina Wong?
Yes. Was she on here? No,
I had a woman named who performance artist named Christina Wong was already on the show, but
painter,
this is a
she
different.
Shows a night gallery?
No, it's maybe a it's a different artist.
Do you know Christina?
I do not.
Well. Maybe her last name isn't Wong, but I'm pretty sure it is.
Okay, go ahead.
She's a painter. Mm-hmm. She does, it's political. It's almost like if Julian Schnabel met Barbara Kruger. It's got Barbara Kruger, like, balls and politics, but it's kind of, maybe Albert Olin. Maybe Albert Olin meeting Jenny Holzer.
Wow.
Nice, nice.
Interesting.
And I think that she has, she can kind of, she says things that I can't believe she could say in her work. And I mean, with text and with imagery that I couldn't say.
Who referred you to her work?
Mika Marple showed it to me at Night Gallery. And it's Wang, W-A-N-G, and you had
Wong.
Got it. I apologize for that.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying.
Got it. Yeah.
Okay. Aaron, who you got?
All right. So, being from the Southwest, I pick as another Southwest artist. It was fairly well known in the 60s and 70s, and it's the late Fritz Scholder, who died in 2005. And he's probably best known as a pop expressionist painter who painted American Indian subjects and worked to upend visual cliches and expand that range of representation. He was born in Breckenridge, Minnesota, and his father was half German and French. And half Luiseno of Southern California Mission Tribe. Mm-hmm. And so Scholder did not grow up as an Indian, like on a reservation, but his father worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the family lived in many Western states over the years. He did not think of himself as an Indian until adulthood. And he traveled and showed widely, including over 100 solo shows, many in New York. And he's in all, you know, many major collections. So MoMA, LACMA, the Hirshhorn, Smithsonian, just to name a few. And I like his work because of its wonderful and vigorous painting style and this unusual color that's attached to a very provocative subject matter. And it often has a scary or dissonant edge and strange humor. And you can see some Diebenkorn Bay Area figurative influence in his work and little Edvard Munch or Goya, little Francis Bacon. But it has that 1960s pop interpretation of imagery, which helps temper that expressionism and adds some needed irony. And I think given that numerous artists are interested in the expressionist idiom and working on it in various ways, from Ruby Neary to Thomas Hausego, Tal R, Eddie Martinez, Henry Taylor, Jonathan Meese, just to name a few, he's a
good. Do you think they were specifically influenced by him generally?
I'm sure they were not. Mm-hmm. Scholder is probably not even. He was a reasonably big act, like I said, but I think that people under, let's say, 45 probably have not heard of him, or even under 50. So I doubt these artists have heard of him. But if you like those artists, you might like Fritz Scholder.
Got it. Excellent. Thank you, Aaron. All right. So kind of. Tailing on the David Robbins to some extent, I have another comic-oriented artist. His name is Cary Leibowitz, a.k.a. Candy Ass. And now, I actually thought that this guy had kind of gone away because I saw his work in the early 90s and hadn't really seen much since. But it turns out he's kind of been showing on and off at like every 7 years, apparently. Andrew Krepp's gallery, I think, has shown him in the 2000s. And in fact, he actually has been working as the worldwide director of contemporary editions at Phillips DePuy and Company. So he's had this interesting day job. But anyway, very funny work. Some would say too one-liner-ish, like, you know, you should be indifferent to it because it's so sort of flat. But I've always found them kind of funny, and I kind of feel like there is room for. He did a car windshield shade with the text, "Please don't steal my radio, I'm queer," in 1994. And he's done many sort of pie chart paintings, you know, with like one giant section has sad, and then a smaller section has sad, and then another smaller section has sad as well. And then I got this checklist from fairly recently. It's you know, written in his sort of casual scrawl. It says please, and then there's a check mark one, and there are these boxes, and the first one says life is great. Next one says things are really looking up. Next one says I'm in a terrific relationship. My weight is under control. My parents are two of my closest friends. And the last one says shut the fuck up. So he actually had a piece at the Armory show outdoors in this year that said big sign text that said I need to start seeing a therapist. So clearly he is continuing to go on sort of despite himself. But I like the fact that he is sort of this self-hating Jew, and he's kind of made that a big part of his work. And like I said, I feel like there's room for that kind of work, even if it is completely one-linerish. All right. Well, this has been the inaugural episode. I want to thank my guests and my co-hosts, I should say, very much. Aaron, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And Carl, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And before we go, please visit the website, theconversationartpodcast.madewithcolor.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes under The Conversation, an Artist Podcast. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. And moving forward, you are hereby invited to submit topic ideas on a weekly basis to the show. Thank you very much for listening, and we will talk to you soon.